Hello! Welcome to the Two Scaramucci's episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. Emily Peck of Axios is with me.
Hi.
Hi, Emily. And Elizabeth Spires.
Hello.
Hello. So you remember what a Scaramucci is, right? It's the length of time that Anthony Scaramucci spent as comms director for Donald Trump. I think it's 11 days. CNN Plus managed to outlast that in its lifetime existence, but not by much. It lasted about two Scaramucci's. So we're going to talk about CNN Plus and Netflix earnings, which were disappointing. Their subscribers going down rather than up. We are also going to talk about mask mandates and why everyone seems to be happy that they are going. We are going to talk about inflation and what it has to do with prices on the internet. And we have a Slate Plus about Elon, because we can't stop talking about Elon. It's all coming up on Slate Money. Okay, so let's talk about streaming, because it was the future of all things televisual until this week, at which point shit got real and CNN Plus got canned and Netflix stock fell off a cliff and Netflix said it was losing subscribers and was going to have to start pivoting to a grab bag of other business models like selling ads and video games and stuff. And what happened? Elizabeth, you're the media person. You understand these things.
I think what we're seeing is just kind of people hitting a ceiling on the number of things that they can subscribe to. And we're in a heavy inflationary environment. So people are looking for areas where they can cut back costs. And Netflix raised prices on the subs pretty recently. So I think, that's just one of the things that people consider maybe dispensable. And when they have to belt tighten, it's a thing that has to go.
Yeah, I will admit that I was one of those people when Netflix raised its price. I texted my wife and I was like, can we cancel Netflix? Because we really don't watch it very much. And it's now expensive if you add up how many dollars a year you're spending on this. It's a non-trivial, we, for reasons, didn't watch much Netflix, and it worked out to about sort of $10 per show or whatever that we were watching. And I'm just like, yeah, it seems expensive, So that was an issue. That was actually, which I want to just come in and say, hey, Netflix, if you're pivoting to weird things like ad-supported and video games, maybe pivot to like a non-subscription model. I would love a non-subscription model for Netflix where you just a la carte pay for whatever you watch, but I suspect they'll never do that.
Yeah, I've always wanted that, because there are some shows on some of these streaming networks, like everyone's talking about them and everyone rushes to subscribe. Like I subscribed to Showtime for like 3 weeks to watch Yellow Jackets and then I tapped out. But it would be cool to not feel bad about that kind of behavior and to just be able to subscribe a la carte. But I don't think that's a winning strategy for the streaming services, whose the subscription model is like hook, get you paying automatic payments and you forget about it and they have a steady stream of revenue coming in.
So that, yeah, there's this in all sort of subscription-based businesses, there's this concept of the lifetime value and the customer acquisition cost. And the idea is that if the value of a subscriber is greater than the cost of acquiring a subscriber, then you're like golden. So there are certain shows which will get you in to subscribe to a service. Like, you will subscribe to Showtime because they have Yellow Jackets, or you will subscribe to Apple Plus because they have Severance or something like that. And then the idea is, once you're subscribed, you're lazy and you'll just keep on paying even if you're not necessarily watching the show. And or there are other shows on that service that you might not subscribe to the service for, but once you have subscribed, you're like, I'm subscribing anyway. There's all of this other stuff on this service, so I'm just going to keep on watching the other stuff. And then you get into the habit and then you stick with it. And this is the thing that I think we've tapped out on, per what Elizabeth was saying, is that there are so many services, and this applies to news subscriptions as well, right? Every single news organization seems to have a subscription that is based on the idea of, if you subscribe to us, then you will come to us and read us every day. And that's just not how people consume the news. There might be one publication that they do that with, but they're not going to do that with all of their publications that they subscribe to. And similarly, if you subscribe to Showtime to watch Yellow Jackets, that doesn't mean that you're going to, when you turn on the television, just fire up your Showtime app and see and say, like, let's see what's on. And when you're in that mode of like, I am only going to navigate to that website when there's a specific article I want to read, or I'm only going to open up the Showtime app when there's a specific show I want to watch, then the value of subscribing becomes much lower.
Yeah, I think also, you know, there's something about Netflix's design that kind of undermines the ability to sort of browse through their catalog. You know, when they move to original programming, they emphasize it so heavily on the platform that if you're just scrolling through the Netflix, you know, dashboard, you're seeing the same shows repeatedly, and they're mostly Netflix's original shows or things that they've recently syndicated. So if they think the value to the customer is partly their larger catalog, they don't make it particularly easy to have for a user to have much visibility into what's there. If you're not specifically searching for something, you know, they're promoting the same handful of shows over and over again. And I think it drags people to thinking about Netflix and some of the other streaming services as largely purveyors of original programming, and the back catalogs don't matter as much.
Well, they are, right? In the Netflix became a streaming giant by having by syndicating a huge number of shows that people would just binge and watch like huge numbers of episodes of. And then now that we're in this much more competitive streaming space and they're up against Peacock and HBO Max and Disney and Hulu and Amazon, most of those shows that they used to syndicate have now gone. And if they're not gone, they're going. Those contracts are running out. So they want to be much more reliant on their own shows, because that's the only thing that they can be reliant on going forwards, really.
Netflix still is the most subscribed to streaming service. It's had insane growth over the past decade, and particularly in the pandemic. Everyone signed up for Netflix. Everyone was watching Netflix. They still have, 100 million households just free riding on other people's passwords. Like, they have a big chunk of viewership, and I mean, and they put out 500 original shows just last year. Like, I think they grew a lot. They were a high growth streaming company. Now there's a lot of competition, and there was a sudden, definitely unexpected, I guess, halt to the growth. I don't think it's like, oh, Netflix is bad now. It's just like, you can't, maybe to borrow like a Felix kind of theme, is like, you can't have the big growth forever. Like, sometimes things slow down. Sometimes they slow down gradually. Sometimes, you know, you go bankrupt slowly, then all at once, or whatever it is. So like, Netflix just like hit a wall. And what's interesting to me is just, I mean, my God, there must have been like 6,522 hot takes about Netflix hitting a wall. I've never seen anything like it. Like, people just really feel passionate about it, which is kind of sort of interesting on itself. And then the other thing I wanted to mention, the user interface on Netflix, I think, is so interesting and kind of good. Like, I will go to Netflix and just like browse to see what's on. And the way they set up the interface now is like, if you hover over a show, it'll show you like a quick little preview. So it almost feels like the old days of like scroll, like channel surfing, because you can get like these little snippets of shows as you go through. Like, they're doing everything they can to draw you into those shows.
Yeah, the discoverability on streaming services is, no one has done it super well in terms of like finding that serendipity of like, oh, that looks interesting, I'll watch it. I think you're right that Netflix probably does it better than most. But, you know, part of the problem is that there are so many different platforms that people watch these things on. You know, there's Apple TV, there's smart TVs, there's Rokus, there's, you know, Chromecasts, that it's very hard to, and then there's just like people watching in a browser on their laptop, it's hard to create a consistently good experience across all of those platforms, because they all have very different limitations. One thing I will say about that is that Apple has famously terrible discovery because of its privacy self-imposed privacy rules, I guess you can call them. Netflix knows everything about you. It knows what you've watched. It knows how much you watched it. It knows when you got bored. It knows what you watched 3 years ago. And it uses all of that information into an algorithm to try and feed you the stuff you're going to be most interested in. Apple, by design, doesn't collect any of that information. So when you open up the Apple TV Plus app, all it does is just show you the same thing that everyone else sees. And so it feels less personalized.
Do you guys think it's the end of binge watching? Like some of these other successful places are one episode at a time places.
I will say, apropos the what you're saying about like the Felix rule of why do companies always need to keep on growing, Netflix fits uncomfortably into that rubric. You know, often I will say, you know, why does the company need to keep on growing? It's a perfectly good, perfectly profitable company, and it can just keep on doing that. Why does the stock market need it to keep on finding new sources of growth? This is a familiar complaint to anyone who listens to Slate Money very often. Netflix is not in that bucket because I don't think it has steady state profitability. It's profitable right now, partly because TV production hasn't really recovered from the pandemic yet. And so it's spending less money than it normally would on new shows, just because it's much harder to make shows because of COVID protocols and stuff. And it is facing much tougher competition. So yes, it is bigger than Disney Plus right now. It is bigger than Hulu right now. But if it just kind of keeps on doing what it's doing, it will continue to lose market share to its competitors and it will shrink. And the economics of Netflix are a bit like the economics of Facebook. Like the amount of money it costs to run a platform like that is so enormous that it can't even pay for itself with its North American subscribers, right? It needs a global level of subscribers just to pay for the content costs. And it needs all of that. It needs that huge scale and that growth in order to keep the flywheel going. If it really does start getting cannibalized by people who are like, I don't want to spend this much for Netflix, Disney Plus is better, Hulu Plus, you know, Hulu is free or much cheaper if it's ad supported or whatever, then that is an existential threat to Netflix. It's not just they can't grow. It becomes they could stop making money and start getting into real trouble.
Although there are some things they could do, like they didn't need to put out 500 original shows last year. No one needed Is This Cake, or maybe they did because it's buzzy. I don't know what the names of the other 400 something.
You know, buying so much, they seem to be looking at themselves as being akin to HBO. You know, just the sheer volume of stuff that they were buying. But then when a lot of that stuff doesn't get made, I feel like the value proposition for them is totally different than it is for HBO. When they buy up IP to keep it out of competitor hands, those dynamics don't necessarily work for Netflix.
What do you mean by buying stuff about and not making it?
HBO used to option stuff all the time just to take it off the table so that, you know, they weren't sure that they wanted to make it, but they didn't want competitors making it. And I think when Netflix buys stuff,
And Netflix does that as well?
No, but they were buying at the volume that HBO was.
You mean
so
optioning?
It was optioning and buying pilots and, you know, okay, stuff like that. So, but with them, they don't have as much incentive to just kind of sit on the IP and not produce shows.
Yeah, I feel like that's just part of like how television works. You option a bunch of stuff and some of it gets made and some of it doesn't for whatever reasons. I don't think they have like a strategy of buying stuff up and not making it. They just have a strategy of buying stuff up and trying to make it and it won't always succeed. And you want to err on the side of buying stuff so that you will get the stuff that gets made. Like you sometimes need to have a wider funnel at the top in order to have a wide enough funnel at the bottom.
Oh, sure. But I think they kind of overdid it the last couple of years and overspent.
But I don't think they overspent on optioning. I think they overspent on making stuff. I think the content costs when they're big are because they're spending millions of dollars per episode on the stuff that they're making, much more than they're spending a whole bunch of money on stuff that they're not making.
Yeah, I think their whole jam on overspending was we're kind of like an unknown place. We need to spend extra to sort of build our brand and get the best people to come to us. So we're going to pay Shonda, you know, millions and millions of dollars to produce Bridgerton and other shows. And we're going to pay creators more than any other platform will pay to attract like quality content and like get an Oscar or whatever. And I think they've like bumped up on the limits of that. I think Netflix said this week it's going to cut back. The Journal had a story that it's going to, you know, cut back on spending and not be so just wild. I think they were kind of a cash cow, like comedians, anyone.
They've canceled a bunch of shows that they bought in the last 12 months that are in development, mostly in the animation department. But
and I feel like the, you know, the prestige movie stuff, you know, Mank and Power of the Dog and Roma and stuff like that. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that. I have this kind of gut feeling that that's moving over a little bit to Apple. Certainly in the wake of Apple winning the Best Picture Oscar. The first streamer to do it. No one expected that, right? No one expected that the first streamer to win the Best Picture Oscar would be Apple rather than Netflix.
And Apple doesn't need streaming, obviously, the way Netflix needs streaming. It's just a part of its business. It's not its core. And even the same with Disney, although it's a different calculation. I mean, I think what happened to Netflix is like streaming is, it's competitive. It's growing up. It's not what it was. And Netflix just like hit that wall. I don't know. Right? It's not.
We should mention CNN Plus as well, just because, you know, that was such a massive disaster. They managed to burn through $9 million a day or something. They lasted two Scaramucci's before they got pulled. Which was this huge bet that the company that has HBO Max, which is this surprisingly successful streamer, instead of including CNN in HBO Max, should create an entirely separate streaming service called CNN Plus that you'd have to pay over and above HBO Max for. This was a big strategic decision. They spent an enormous amount of money on it. And then this decision was made in the knowledge that they were getting bought by Discovery and that the new executives were Discovery executives and that they would have their own strategic outlook on life. And then the Discovery executives, basically the day that the deal closes, say, wait a minute, you know, CNN Plus makes no sense. It's going to take years, if ever, before it becomes profitable. It's not core to how we see this company working, and they just kill it. And on the one hand, I kind of like the idea that the rules about, like, you can't talk about strategy with your future acquirer until the deal is closed, you know, seem to have worked in this case. Like, you know, it's good that companies can't control a company before they've bought it. But on the other hand, you kind of don't want to make a massive strategic bet of that magnitude unless you have some indication that your new acquirers are going to be on board with it.
Yeah, it's dumb. It's dumb. When I was at Huffington Post, and behind the scenes, everyone knew they were about to get acquired by BuzzFeed, but like plebs like me didn't know. We would be pitching long-term, I was pitching long-term projects all the time, and I would just keep hearing like, wait and see, or let's meet on that next month, or, you know, people put it off because they were like, we don't know what's going to happen. It's just common sense. Why would you make a multi-billion dollar bet right before you're getting acquired?
There's a lot of baffling internal logic there. You know, not just that, thinking, there seemed to be some idea that if they just rammed it through, then new owners would just say, well, now we're stuck with it. We're just going to keep doing it.
Yeah, it's a fait accompli. Yeah, it's like, no, that's not how Discovery works.
Well, the other thing was that there was a specific executive, and I don't remember who it was internally at CNN Plus, who kept sort of selling the idea internally as being equivalent to the Times digital subscription business. These are two utterly different things. You know, it's sort of like they couldn't work out what their internal analogy was for why anybody was going to want this product. And so they were just sort of casting about for something that seemed more necessary than CNN Plus would, ostensibly. But it just doesn't make any sense, really.
Also, the whole time, okay, CNN is a 24-hour channel. What the hell do you need Plus for? Like, it's on all the time. If there is content you feel like you need to add to it, you have 24 hours to do it.
I can answer that question, Emily.
Thank you.
The answer to that question is all based around cable contracts. So CNN is a 24-hour cable, if you a 24-hour cable channel, which is only available if you pay money to a cable provider for cable TV. And if you don't, you can't watch it. And it's completely inaccessible to you. And the way that the cable providers, the deal that they do when they pay money, every subscriber winds up, you know, for, if you subscribe to cable, then a certain amount of that subscription fee goes straight to CNN. And under the terms of that deal, CNN is not allowed to stream that content. It can only go through cable. So if CNN wants to be able to reach people who don't pay for cable, they need some other way of doing it. They can't just repurpose the existing CNN content. This is why it took so long for all of the other media companies to get into the streaming business. It's precisely because they were making so much money from cable that they couldn't understand how it made sense to try and like take that, you know, they couldn't get out of those cable contracts. And so they wound up being very late to streaming.
So there's like a big structural issue at play that is sort of, if not being ignored, then not being brought into like the 2020s, right? I mean, I absolutely want to be able like to stream
CNN,
this news.
CNN is an incredibly profitable franchise, right? Because they get, you know, however much it is, $2 per subscriber per month, like for everyone who gets cable TV. But over the long term, if the number of subscribers to cable TV goes down and down and down, which almost certainly will, then the amount of money that CNN gets is going to go down and down and down. And if you want growth rather than shrinkage, you're going to need to do something else. That was the entire strategic imperative behind CNN Plus. The only good example of people streaming live anything, really, is sports. And even that is still largely tied up with long-term cable contracts and broadcast contracts.
Yeah, sports is the good counterexample. I can't, could you imagine paying more for more CNN? I really never understood it.
But but Emily, you are coming at this from the point of view of someone who already has CNN, right?
Yeah, but I mean, the only reason to watch CNN is like if something major is happening and you want to see what's going on. But it's not like, ooh, Tuesday night, what are we going to do, fam? Let's put on CNN and just hang out. Like, no.
No. You should open up CNN Plus and watch Jake Tapper's book club.
I'm speechless now. I don't know.
All right. Let's whereof we cannot speak, thereof must we remain silent.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Congratulations, guys. The pandemic is over.
Yay.
There's some like crazy federal judge in Florida decided that mask mandates were unconstitutional or some such. And then the general reaction to this was surprising to me. Everyone goes, oh, yeah, great. Like, no one really loved the reasoning. The jurisprudence here was, to use a technical term, batshit. But everyone was like, oh, yeah, okay, like it might be batshit, but let's just run with this. And the airlines were like, yeah, we are not going to enforce this anymore. Even the Biden administration didn't seem to push back against it very much. Everyone who had mask mandates was like, well, I guess there's nothing we can do. We're just going to have to get rid of them. Because it seemed quite clear to me from the reaction that the people who had the mask mandates just didn't like those mask mandates, and they kind of wanted an excuse to get rid of them.
I mean, they were causing trouble on airlines, according to the reports, right? A lot of unruly passengers. extra work for anyone who's on the flight attendants, you know, having to enforce these rules. It's like a new part of people's job that you don't get compensated for, and you get a lot of anger and pushback for having to enforce mask mandates. So I could see why, as an employee of an airline, you'd be pretty relieved to have it go away, except for if you're worried about being sick.
I think one other thing is that it became more and more obvious to the people who were implementing the mandates that they weren't really working, that people would kind of half wear those like little baby surgical masks, mostly under their noses, and they just weren't effective. That in the age of Omicron and the super infectious variants, you really, in order for a mask mandate to work, you need many more people to be wearing N95s and N94s, which fit well. And there's no mask mandate anywhere in the world where people actually do that. And so it was like, if they're not that effective to begin with, do we really need them?
Well, it's not just the efficacy issue. I think part of what happened was, you know, even if you're required to wear a mask on a plane or, you know, in public transportation, if you can take the mask off to eat, this sort of reinforces the idea to people who are anti-mask that this is all theater. Because just common sense tells you that that sort of defeats the purpose of wearing the mask in the first
especially
place.
Especially when on an airplane, everyone eats at exactly the same time. So everyone takes their masks off at exactly the same time. You're like, wait, this does not make epidemiological sense.
But it's not clear to me. There was Axios had a poll today that most people, a majority of people said they're still fine with wearing masks on planes. They want to wear the masks on planes.
The problem is the people who are really not fine with it are super vocal. Those are the people picking fights on planes.
Right.
I think most of us, I mean, speaking for myself anyway, I will continue to wear a mask on planes. Like, wearing a mask does not make me feel angry or terrible. And I'm just like, yeah, I'll do it. I'm perfectly happy wearing a mask. I'll do it unilaterally. The question is really, is there a purpose served to the mandate? And I think that there is a strong case to be made that one, it causes very bad behavior by people who are strongly opposed to wearing a mask at all, and you kind of don't want that behavior. And two, that there is this way in which people try and get away with doing the least possible amount of masking while still pretending that they are paying lip service to the idea of wearing a mask. And when you have so much kind of half-hearted masking, it's far from clear to me that a mandate is actually achieving very much.
Also, I want to just say, anytime something gets labeled a mandate in the United States, it is doomed. People hate a mandate. Like, it doesn't matter what it is. Healthcare mandate, which was just like, you have to have healthcare or you have to pay this minimal fine, huge issue. Vaccine mandate. Everyone hated that, even though we have all other kinds of vaccine mandates. As soon as you label something mandate, it's over. It's going to fail. There will be some crazy judge in Florida like this one who shuts down your mandate.
We have freedom, goddammit. You can't force me to do anything. This is America.
Yeah, it's a big rhetoric fail.
There's a concept in child psychology called demand resistance, where, you know, children, when told to do something, will just knee-jerk not do it because they don't like being forced to do anything. And, you know, to some extent, there's a whole huge swath of America that just is in permanent demand resistance. So I think that's part of what you're saying, the sort of the language makes it sound like the government is demanding that you do something.
Yeah. And
just, it doesn't matter what it is. It's there's going to be resistance.
And the irony is we're talking about air travel. I think many people pointed this out. Liz Lenz noted it in her email that I read all the time. Like one time a guy put a bomb in his shoe and got on a plane and it didn't go off, right? I believe. Ever since then, we've all taken off our shoes like blind sheep. Every time, you know, you go through security, everyone just takes off their shoes. It's a mandate. No one, I mean, it's fine.
Unless
no
you have pre-check, in which case you don't.
Sure, fine. But you know, like we do all kind. We're jumping through a lot of hoops to get on an airplane these days. So it's a little weird that like this one was the one. It was too far.
But security theater is interesting, right? People don't like security theater, but they do feel like they have less political control over it. It's hard to, as a politician, to run on, you know, a platform of I'm going to make the airports less safe by ratcheting down security, whereas epidemiology and but like public health theater is much, you know, people are, is a much more politically valent issue, and it is possible to run on a platform of like I'm going to get rid of COVID restrictions, and people will vote for that.
Yes, people are constantly voting for less health restrictions and trying to dodge various.
Yeah, there's some disturbing research around that I think sort of plays into what you're saying about security theater, where there's a report that came out a few weeks ago that said that once people understood that COVID was more likely to affect people who were immunocompromised or minorities, they were less willing to do basic things to stem COVID spread. And with security theater, things like, you know, shoe bombers, I think the average person thinks, well, that could happen to me. But there's a huge swath of America who thinks, well, I'm a healthy person, I'm not going to get COVID. And they just don't really care about how it affects other people. So I think part of the difference, too, is individual risk perception about how much of a problem this might be for you individually. And that'll determine the extent to which you're willing to do pro-social things to mitigate COVID.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that I have seen happen with COVID is that it has become a completely unterrifying disease for most people. And it is still a terrifying disease for some people. And there is still a terrifying number of deaths every day caused by COVID. But if your friend says, oh, I can't come out tonight because I've got COVID, you're like, oh, okay. And you're not worried about your friend normally, you know?
Right. It has become a very, at the start of the whole thing, it was a very much a public health issue, a community problem. And now with vaccines, it's become like another quintessential, like American personal responsibility kind of thing. Like there's new data out, I think on Friday or Thursday, about 250,000 of COVID deaths in the U.S. were people who weren't vaccinated yet, like is attributable to people not getting a vaccine. I feel like that gives cover to this feeling of like, it's fine, I can handle it kind of mentality.
Yeah, I also think that the sort of people's psychological bellwether for when they think COVID is really over is a moving target. And so initially it was, you know, whenever we get vaccines. But I think one of the big markers in everybody's head was when I don't have to wear a mask on public transportation, airlines in particular. So I feel like this is a lot more psychologically significant than it is in terms of how it affects the airline business specifically. And part of the reason why DOJ is challenging that ruling, but the administration is not being too vocal about it because they realize that so many people want this to be over, and they think it is, that they don't want to be the bad news people who show up and say, actually, it's not, we're going to reverse this.
I want it to be over.
I have a theory that the pandemic ended in terms of a public, sort of understood to be a public health emergency on the day that Russia invaded Ukraine. One of the genius things that Jeff Zucker did at CNN was he realized that the public could only have one story in its head at any one time. We're just not smart enough to be able to think about more than one thing at a time. And so, you know, for a long time, it was like, there is a missing plane. And he would just, that was the one story that you would see on CNN. And then it was Trump. Trump was the one story on CNN for many years. And he got Trump elected basically by just going full on, like, Trump is the only thing people can watch. And then it was the pandemic. And for a while, like, the pandemic was the one story that basically dominated the planet. And that ended with the invasion of Ukraine. Now it is Ukraine. It is not the pandemic anymore.
Maybe. I don't know. The George Floyd protests kind of overshadowed COVID for a while, I think, and was the story for a while.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We should talk about inflation. I had a theory in my newsletter this week that one of the things that is making inflation surprisingly easy is dynamic pricing. That because everything is on the internet and everything is digital, prices can move around much more than they used to be able to move around. And that makes it easier for people to raise prices. And it also makes it harder for people to have a mental idea of what prices should be. And if you don't have a mental idea of what prices should be, that makes you less price sensitive. Do you buy it?
I fully buy it. I'm fully buying it.
I buy it, but I think that there's one thing that cuts against that is just the psychology of inflation generally, which is that everybody knows we're in an inflationary environment and they're constantly being told things are more expensive. They may believe that they are, even if the prices that they're looking at on a daily basis don't reflect that.
One thing I learned doing some reporting this week is that if prices at the supermarket go up on like one thing you buy, like your meat's more expensive, you start believing everything is more expensive, even though it's not, because it's confusing. And there are a lot of prices on a lot of things because you're buying lots and lots and lots of different stuff at the supermarket. So not only is Felix's theory of like the prices of things are changing all the time, so no one even really knows what the right price is anymore. It's like you kind of like extrapolate from one data point a bigger trend. Everything's going up, even though it's not.
And it's true that when you go shopping at the supermarket, you don't have a mental model of how much your entire cart is supposed to. Well, you might have a mental model of like roughly how much you spend overall, but you don't have a mental model of how much every single item in your cart is going to cost. You have a mental model of one or two items in your cart that, for whatever reason, you know, price of a box of crackers stuck in your head, or the price of a dozen eggs stuck in your head, or whatever it was. And when that one changes, you're like, ah, I saw that one change. Even when when the other ones change, you don't notice it, but everyone has different items that are salient for them.
Although I think not a grocery, but gas prices in particular, high salience for everybody. And they just take up a huge amount of real estate in terms of the way people think about expenses, and you know, just completely outsized proportion to what people are spending categorically.
So Emily, does that then also apply to what you were talking about? Like, if gas prices go up, do people think that everything else has gone up just because gas prices have gone up, or is it just within supermarkets?
Well, my reporting was supermarket confined, but it's not a leap to believe that that's also true. People see gas prices getting much higher, and then they they see a lot of stories about inflation, and then they think everything's cost more. But people adjust their behavior in ways I hadn't considered. I started doing some reporting this week because I was like, oh, meat prices are up. I mean, the data from the CPI report was wild. It was like 20% for this, 15% for that. I was like, oh, maybe people are buying cheaper kinds of meat or something, or going vegetarian. And I was speaking to a supermarket analyst, and she was like, well, what actually happens is people just buy less meat. You just kind of like rifle through the meat packages and just buy things that weigh less, that cost less. And it's like you just start adjusting. So maybe you're in the end, your grocery cart costs basically the same because you've made these like little weird adjustments and stuff like that. And maybe it's a good thing that people eat less meat. So I don't know.
That's why I always thought the idea of hedonic substitution, where you are switching from, you know, filet mignon to ground beef, never made any intuitive sense to me, because I've never seen anybody actually do that. To sort of say like, well, I was in the mood for a steak, but now I'm just going to have a hamburger. Like, I just don't think that it happens in the real world. I think you just have fewer steaks.
I do it. I switch stuff. I bought, like we used to buy flank steak. I'd buy like chucks.
It happened to me with wine. Like, there's been a bunch of wine inflation over the past few years, and I basically moved from, you know, I used to drink a lot of Loire wines because they were cheaper, and then they became more expensive, and now I'm drinking other, you know, so like German reds and stuff that are cheaper because, you know, I've decided I prefer them, but like one of the things pushing me in that direction is also like, if I can get something I prefer that's cheaper, then it's much easier to make that switch.
Yeah. I'm very interested in what people are doing to sort of adjust to price inflation so people can email.
SlateMoney@slate.com. The one thing I'll say about supermarkets is that there has been a revolution in what is known as menu costs. It used to be, back when people were studying inflation in the 70s, which was the last time anyone really cared about inflation, that there were real costs to changing the prices in a supermarket. You'd need to pay human beings to walk down the aisles and literally physically change the prices on everything. And now with these like e-ink price displays, it's all, you just press a button and the price changes. And you can change the price every day. And they do. The prices in supermarkets change super frequently because the cost of changing the price has gone way, way down.
Yeah. That's really interesting too. I want to talk to someone from The Price is Right and see, like, are people getting the price wrong more now because it's more confusing?
Yes. Really? Yes, they are. There's a paper about this. Yeah. I actually linked to it from my, newsletter. There is a paper where people have downloaded every single episode of The Price is Right over however many seasons. There's like 40 seasons or something. And the accuracy of the guesses is going down and down and down over time because people don't know how much things cost anymore.
I feel like I've seen that the Arrested Development meme way more in the last year. How much can it possibly cost, Michael? What's a banana? $10?
Bananas are always cheap. Yeah,
if someone charged me $10 for a banana right now, I would be like, I would barely blink. We should have a numbers round. Elizabeth, you have a number?
Yeah, 450,000. This comes from a story that's a couple of weeks old, but new to me. There's a company called WorldCoin that's backed by Andreessen Horowitz and Sam Altman, and they have a piece of technology called an orb, and they're scanning the irises of people in developing countries to develop
identity network. Amazing, yeah.
And they've already scanned 450,000 people, mostly in low-income countries, not at all creepy, and they pay the orb operators 14 cents a scan. So they've spent $63,000.
Dystopian about this at all.
Super creepy.
What is the goal?
To create a new global payment coin thing.
Yes, and a global identity system that's completely, ironically, centralized.
Where you just look into a phone and it will look into your eyes and it'll be like, I know who you are. Yeah, this is, yeah, well, yeah. Anyway, it's terrifying. My number is 500. Which is the number of dollars that NYU students are being offered for tickets to their commencement ceremony at Yankee Stadium. Every NYU student gets like two tickets. They can have like two people come and watch them graduate. And now there's like an active secondary market in these tickets, even though you're not allowed to sell them. Like NYU is like, we tell you, you are not allowed to sell them. They are not transferable. But people are transferring them, and you know why? It is because Taylor Swift is getting an honorary doctorate.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I'm surprised it's not higher than $500 a ticket.
She is not going to be performing, but she is going to be speaking.
Wow.
I feel like you need to be a real Taylor Swift stan to like want to see her receive an honorary doctorate, but there is no shortage of those.
And, like, won't the video just be on the internet and, like, right after?
Yeah, won't it be streamed? Exactly. Yeah. Watch it on CNN free. Plus. Emily.
My number is 4.5%. That is the number of vehicle crashes increased in Texas 4.5% after the state started putting up signs reminding people of road fatalities. So,
what? Like a public health intervention that managed to make it worse?
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yes. It's a new study this week. Yes. They looked at the impact of these roadsides in Texas and found that they they cause more fatalities.
This number needs to be higher.
Yeah, yeah.
Number go up. Yeah.
Yeah. It was kind of counterintuitive.
So wait, you put up a sign saying, this is a dangerous road. It, you know, 800 people have died on it in the past 10 years. And people are going, oh, shit, it's dangerous. I should, like, run off the road and kill someone.
Yeah, it says something like, the sign will say something like, there have been 1,600 traffic fatalities in Texas so far this year, whatever it is. And they're like these big signs. And the idea is to make people drive more safely. But apparently, big signs on roads are distracting, according to the study. And
it's true.
It creates some anxiety in people.
Like, it is absolutely, especially like in large swathes of America, which are just covered in billboards. Billboards are a public health hazard. They are distracting, and no one regulates that. One of my favorite little corners of philanthropy is something that Bloomberg Philanthropies actually specializes in, which is public health interventions to reduce road fatalities. And there are proven ways to do it, and some of them are very low cost. You know, some of them involve, you know, just little signs in buses saying, you know, please sit down rather than standing up, stuff like that. Some of them are more elaborate, but it's one of the most bang for the buck interventions that you can do if you get it right. You can save a lot of lives for relatively low cost if you get the road fatality stuff right. But it's thankless, right? Because no one knows when their life has been saved by one of these interventions.
One thing that wasn't clear to me from reading the story about the study or skimming through the study is there is a roadside intervention where I live where they put up like a sign that tells you how fast you're going. And they say, it says like speed limit is 35, and then you pass it and it says like, you're going 45, slow down. And I always slow down and I feel terrible. And now I'm not clear. If anyone knows, they could email us. I'm not clear. Does that work or does that make also?
Yeah, those ones work.
Yeah. It seems like it does, because and speeding is one of like the three main drivers of traffic accidents: speeding, drinking, and something else.
One of the ones that I like, and I haven't seen it very much, but I've definitely seen it in Manhattan, is putting little louvers on top of green lights so that you can't see them from very far away. And you need to drive up to relatively close to the light before you can like look up through the louvers and see that it's green. And what that does is it stops speeding, because there was this phenomenon on like New York City cross streets where people would see the green light and then be like, oh shit, I need to floor it to be able to get through the green light. And then if you can't see the green light, they don't do that. Anyway, that's my favorite try and reduce road deaths intervention. If you have more, send them in, slatemoney@slate.com. We will be back on Tuesday with the one and only Cardiff Garcia talking about Office Space. You remember that 1999 movie? 1999 was a great year for movies. So we're talking about Office Space on Tuesday. Tune in for that if you're into the movies. And otherwise, we'll be back on Saturday with yet another Shayna Roth-produced Slate Money.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.